Welcome back to the Ag News Daily Show.
So, you know, in the last 2 to 3 years, we've totally revamped our grain cart line. We had two older models that we started probably 15 years ago. And 2 to 3 years ago, we decided it was time to do a complete revamp and change some stuff and then try to get on the cutting edge of grain carts.
Across the South, I mean, you come down here to this part of Texas, we've got places that are 10 times the normal rainfall just in the last 30 days. That means that they've had, through the beginning of May, their entire year's worth of rainfall already.
It's still fun to greet you both on the podcast format and on video. Delaney, are you still enjoying the new show?
I think so. I think our listeners are as well.
You seem to be a lot more chipper than I am this morning. I feel like we're getting a push here into late planting season.
We are. We'll touch on that here in just a little bit. But, you know, weather certainly impacted some of the planting that we saw this week, Tanner.
I know. But looking ahead at our schedule today, do I really need to give it up weather update? Because I feel like I'm the least qualified. Can I just say, hey, hang in for 15 minutes and we're going to get to a better forecast?
Yeah, that might be a good line.
Okay, fine. Well, I'll at least do a little bit of headlines for the listeners. Short-term improvements have improved some of the drought conditions in the Midwestern states. Recent heavy rainfall in several of the states led to a widespread improvement in the drought conditions. However, we still have some long-term impacts of drought remaining as a concern. The latest drought monitor map for Iowa reflected a slight improvement in the drought-free acres from the previous week, which was up by 12%, currently sitting at 52.5% of the state drought-free. The 20% is abnormally dry, 11.5% is in that D1 moderate drought, and the remaining 16% is still in D2 severe drought. According to the latest drought monitor map for Nebraska, 92% of the state is drought-free or in not any drought stress. This is a significant improvement from the start of the year. When we look back at September 26th of 2023, only 35% of the state's acres were drought-free. In Kansas, 32% of the state is in D2 severe drought, 19 is in D2 moderate drought, and 32% is abnormally dry. The remaining 17 is the only portions free from drought stress, Delaney. So not free and clear all over the country, but at least some states are getting some relief.
Yeah, a lot of relief, especially when we look at subsoil moisture as well. But Tanner, we can't take too much of Eric's thunder, no pun intended. So stay tuned as we talk with Eric Snodgrass for his in-depth weather analysis coming up later in the episode. As we take a look at the latest crop progress report, as of May 12, 49% of the U.S. corn crop was planted, up 36% from the week prior, but down from the five-year average of 54%. Soybean progress showed up 35% complete, up from 25% the week prior. The U.S. wheat tour is also wrapping up this week, revealing pretty variable conditions across the state of Kansas. For the three-day tour, participants traveled 6 different routes in both northern and southern Kansas, and participants on the northern route of the tour mentioned they saw some of the best-looking wheat they have seen in years, while participants in southern routes saw the opposite with drought-stricken fields. The three-day average yield for fields was calculated at 46.5 bushels per acre, with the official tour projection for total production of wheat in the state of Kansas estimated at 290.4 million bushels, Tanner. So it does seem like that drought monitor you mentioned there is impacting winter wheat country as well.
Yeah, I wondered, and I'm glad that you shared that update for us. We also got an update from Ag Bankers. They say that farm income is down in 2023 in the Central Plains. Strong cattle prices have supported profits for cow-calf producers in the recent months, but a steep decline in prices of many key crops weighed in on the incomes over the last year. This is according to the Kansas City Fed. Farm income retracted at a sharp pace in the Central Plains ahead of the spring planting season. Based on a survey of ag bankers, 60% of lenders said their highest percentage of answers since 2020 that the income was lower than a year earlier. More than 70% of ag bankers in Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska, states with higher share of their income coming from row crops, said that farm incomes were lower in the first quarter of this year than at the same point of 2023. Lenders expected farmland values and cash rental rates to hold steady through the spring months. Some 59% of ag bankers said they believed farmland would be overvalued in the first quarter of 2024. The Kansas City Federal Reserve District covers Colorado, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Wyoming, northern New Mexico, and western Missouri to give you an idea of where the data is coming from. What a great positive note to start the day off, though, Delaney. Unfortunately, some of the ag bankers are seeing, or at least speaking, a little bit of doom and gloom. So it might be time to rip that Band-Aid off and get started on some financial planning.
Yeah, absolutely. We knew this year was going to be a different year for farmers. And adding to some of that challenge, especially in the commodity markets, has been weakening U.S. demand. This week, the United States unveiled new tariff increases on Chinese imports of various products, including electric vehicle batteries, computer chips, and various medical products. Although China has not responded directly yet with more tariffs, in response to the United States' new tariffs, the China's foreign minister was quoted by Reuters as saying that the U.S. may be losing their minds. China also immediately vowed to retaliate to the move. And although agriculture was not specifically mentioned, it's safe to say China is not happy about this move and may look to try and further cut their U.S. ag imports from the United States. As China does look elsewhere, President Putin and President Xi Jinping met this week to discuss their continued country's partnership. The official line is that the two countries were discussing trade deals involving energy and agriculture. Following their meetings this week, the two countries announced a pledge to a new era of partnership between the two countries, Tanner. In a 7,000-word joint statement, the two sides pledged to deepen their relationship and partnership and cooperation on a variety of different topics. Notable highlights included nods at the U.S.'s involvement in Taiwan and Ukraine, and pledging deeper cooperation throughout the agricultural, energy, industrial, and technology sectors for the two countries. So more to come, I'm sure, on that headline, Tanner, as those relationships continue to progress.
That's right. I feel it's kind of like our relationship. You say I'm losing my mind a lot. But we will continue to give updates on this story. Some Iowa farmers were interrupted by solar storms this week. As many farmers who rely on satellite data to plant their fields, they were delayed in recent days by a geomagnetic storm, according to field agronomists who have been monitoring corn and soybean planting thus far. The storm, caused by recent bursts of plasma and magnetic field from the sun's corona, developed on Friday and led to a spectacular nighttime show of colored bands of light in many states that were seeing the northern lights. Oh, it's in air quotes. The northern lights, which is typically uncommon. But it also disrupted radio signals of the country's global positioning system, which most farmers are using to steer their tractors. HTS Ag out of Harlan, which installs GPS technology in tractors, was inundated with calls from its farmer customers between 3 and 7 p.m. on Friday. Adam Gittins, the president of the company, reported, "This was a strong geomagnetic storm that hit the planet and has been the strongest since about 2003, he said. "We won't know the full implication until crops come up. The effect on equipment was variable, Delaney. The locating errors ranged from several feet to several hundred feet. Gittins said the most of his customers just stopped planting and waited for the storm's effects to subside. Wet conditions in the recent weeks have already delayed planting as farmers approach crucial deadlines to complete their work, or they risk losing yield potential. So this was just one more challenge for them to overcome this spring."
Did you see the northern lights, though? They were really beautiful.
They were. But I was in bed.
Okay, well, at least you weren't one of those farmers impacted by the GPS impact. That was a wild story to read that last week. Well, late last week, the Biden administration announced new financial incentives for dairy farms to stop the spread of avian influenza. As part of a plan announced by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the administration will pay up to $28,000 per dairy farm over the next 4 months to support some very specific activities to stop the spread. Now, Tanner, these activities are pretty in-depth here, so let's run through them quickly. But some of those activities, again, that could add up to $28,000, include up to $2,000 of financial support for affected farms per month for producers to supply PPE equipment to workers or to help them wash their uniforms. They will also provide support of up to $1,500 per affected premise to develop biosecurity plans based on existing secure milk supply plans. This includes recommended enhanced biosecurity for individuals that frequently move between dairy farms, such as milk haulers, veterinarians, feed trucks, AI technicians, and others. In addition to that, the USDA will pay a $100 payment to producers who purchase and use an inline sampler for their milk system. They'll also provide funding for heat treatment to dispose of milk in a biosecure fashion. This will provide producers a safe option, they said, for the disposal of milk, and heat treatment performed in accordance with the standards set by FDA is currently the only available method considered to effectively inactivate the virus in the milk. If a producer establishes a system to heat treat all waste milk before disposal, they'll be eligible for that payment. The USDA will also pay producers up to $2,000 per affected premise per month and reimburse producers for veterinarian costs associated with confirmed and positive cases of H5N1 premises. This provides support to producers to cover veterinarian costs necessary incurred by treating cattle affected with H5N1, as well as fees for veterinarians to collect samples for testing. This could also include veterinarian fees and/or specific supplies needed for treatment and sample collection, and veterinary costs are eligible to be covered from the initial date of positive confirmation for that farm up to $10,000 per affected premise. And finally, they can also use that money to offset shipping costs for the testing that has to go to the National Animal Health Laboratory Network, up to $50 per shipment. Tanner, this is available under the USDA's Emergency Assistance for Livestock, Honeybees, and Farm-Raised Fish program to compensate eligible producers, but it's unclear, however, after reading through the various government updates that I did this week, how producers go about signing up for that assistance. So I would suggest to go to your nearest FSA office for more information.
Yeah, no kidding.
The Association of Equipment Manufacturers this week released their April 2024 Ag and Tractor Combine Sales Report. That report reflected a few big takeaways here: that in the U.S. market, unit sales of four-wheel drive ag tractors increased 24% compared to 2023 and are up 1.9% year-to-date. In the U.S., 100-plus horsepower tractor unit sales increased 7.2% year-over-year. In Canada, unit sales of combines jumped 73.5% compared to April of last year. And in Canada, unit sales of four-wheel drive ag tractors grew 7.2% compared to 2023, a 9.2% year-to-date update there.
Can I have a chance to talk?
Absolutely.
We'll okay.
Give one now.
Hey, well, the House Ag Chairman G.T. Thompson released a title-by-title overview of the current House Farm Bill draft ahead of the upcoming markup coming May 23rd. Senate Ag Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow followed suit, releasing the House markup as well. The $1.5 trillion bill will fund farming programs, SNAP, WIC, nutrition programs, and more over the next 5 years or until another bill is released. Discussions over where that funding will come from has been largely the holdup for the path going forward. Some notable inclusions in the House's version of the bill: boosting crop subsidy support by 56% or $23 billion, raising the price loss coverage reference prices by 10% to 20%, depending on the commodity, while also providing an increase in income protection for growers under the Agriculture Risk Coverage Program and crop insurance. The big one, looking at cutting SNAP spending by $28 billion over the next 10 years. We'll have more to come next week, as we should see that official markup coming. But in other news, Delaney, John Deere released their earnings report this week, and on Thursday, they trimmed its annual profit forecast for the second time and projected steeper declines in the sales of large agricultural equipment as farmers are balking at buying tractors and combines due to the falling crop prices. However, the world's largest farm equipment maker expects sales of large equipment to decline between 20 and 25% this year, compared to prior estimates of roughly 20% from last fall. Still, the company topped their second quarter estimates. Net income fell by 17% to $2.37 billion, or $8.53 per share, but that beat their estimates of $7.86 per share. But now let's talk about more machinery news with Kyle from Brandt Equipment. All right, it's time to chat an update from Brandt. We got Kyle Bennett here joining us today to give us a little bit about what's been working for them this year. Welcome to the podcast, Kyle.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it, Tanner. Glad to be on and appreciate the opportunity.
So where are you coming into from today?
Yeah, so I'm in Lawson, Missouri, just outside of Kansas City here at the home office.
That's cool. And how long have you been with Brandt?
About 7 years now. So May's coming up on 7 years. So it's been a good run with them so far.
Have you been doing the same thing for Brandt that you have since you joined the team?
No, I haven't. I started out as a territory manager, managing Missouri and Kansas, and then that morphed into Missouri, Kansas, and Oklahoma with a bunch of different product lines through our distribution networks, and then been doing the current role for about a year now. So,
awesome. So in your area, what are the most popular Brandt products that your customers are interested in?
Yeah, so where I'm at, the augers and the field belts are kind of our bread and butter, kind of the staple of what we manufacture and largest movers, per se, on that stuff.
Yeah, I can tell. I got firsthand experience with one of your Brandt augers, and I can't remember the model number right now, but I think it's 110 foot.
Yeah.
And there's been millions of bushels put through that auger, and she still runs just as good as, well, I shouldn't say just as good, but it's holding up really well.
They've done great over the years. Brandt really prides herself on their quality and being a premium product. You know, the good thing is augers eventually wear out. So, but we try to make them last as long as we can. And they've done really well for us. It's amazing the growth that we've had over the years. So,
yeah, that's kind of neat. So we were down in Houston for Commodity Classic this year and got to have a little bit of fun. We had some donuts at your booth, and unfortunately it didn't look like your booth was large enough to have this equipment on display. So now it'll be exciting to talk to our listeners about what you guys have to offer this year. So let's start first with how I originally got connected to Brandt, and that was through your grain carts. So what kind of news you got coming out of that sector?
Yeah, so, you know, in the last 2 to 3 years, we've totally revamped our grain cart line. So, you know, we had two older models that we were building for, you know, started probably 15 years ago. And 2 to 3 years ago, we decided it was time to do a complete revamp and change some stuff and try to get on the cutting edge of grain carts. And we came out with a new XT, which is our corner auger cart, which you're familiar with. You guys got to play around with this past fall, and then the recent one would be our DXT, which is our dual auger grain cart, which just released last year and really ramped the production on those this year. So
I think that'd be kind of fun to play around with. Might have to reach back out to you guys, see if we can get a DXT to compare this fall and see how things run. But my first connection was as a part of the advisory team that was called upon to give some feedback. You know, I don't get to run the combine very often in the family operations that I'm a part of, so I end up spending a lot of hours in the grain cart, either that or the semi. So it was neat that you cared about our opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's a huge part of the process when we went to redesign these carts. You know, we have these customer advocacy groups like you were a part of, and you know, we really wanted to dig in to what the customer wanted to see in a grain cart. You know, like if you were to design one from the ground up, what would you have? What would you keep? What would you get rid of? And, you know, ultimately at the end of it, the XT, you know, grain cart that we have is what, you know, that customer advocacy group was asking for. So it's been really cool to kind of see that from, you know, the thoughts to the design to the conception of this cart.
Well, even last year, like I said, when we got to run it, you know, mainly Corey and his family on their farm, but we even had a couple of tips to send back as well that went back into consideration for little things to improve. I still can't believe how far forward that auger reaches.
It's way out there. So it's, you know, it's all, well, you know, you've ran the grain cart a lot. It's all about operator comfort and, you know, the longer hours in the tractor, and we try to make it as easy to unload and use as possible. Key to that is getting that auger out in front where you can see it. So
now, have you ever had anybody hit the cab of the tractor with one of those augers?
You know, we haven't. I think you'd run into the hitch first. But we, you know, when we started the prototype in these grain carts, we took some down to Arkansas and Rice Country, and we had a 1300 size hooked up to a quad track, and we tried to hit it. You know, we were cutting it real sharp and stuff, and we never got in contact with it. So it looks like it, you know, could happen, but Luckily, it's not. Not saying it would never, but it's far enough away it should.
No, I think that's really key and something that's going to set you guys apart from everybody else in the industry. It's one of those that, it was pre-COVID when I got to sit on that committee and provide my opinion. And that's all it was, right? Was an opinion. And I'm looking forward to getting that invite back again to come see them put together, assembled. Since COVID happened, when that tour was supposed to get scheduled, kind of put the kibosh on that.
Yeah. Well, we're back in full force now and open to tours. So we'll definitely set that up with you guys. I'd love to have you over, check out the factory. You know, it's over in Hudson, Illinois. And that's our dedicated grain cart facility. So we're just popping grain carts out of there. So it'd be great to have you guys over.
It's been fun too, watching some of these fertilizer spreaders toting around your conveyor belts, or you call them field belts. And just seeing how easy, especially the self-contained ones, that they can unhook in the field. Most of the time, like I said, it's lime or fertilizer that I see back underneath of it with their spreader, and away they go.
Yeah, those field belts have become so handy. You know, it kind of started as, how do we unload our bins more efficiently with a product that's going to last longer? And, it morphed into this fully self-contained unit that, drive around between bins. You got guys taking it to the field to do bulk fertilize. It's been a great unit. That's probably one of our most recognizable units for sure, just because we've been building them for so long and there's so many out there.
So remind our listeners where Brandt is headquartered and how Brandt started.
Yeah, so Brandt's headquartered in Regina, Saskatchewan. It's a family-owned company. The Simple family owns it. They started, manufacturing ag equipment back in the 40s. So from there, they've just grown their ag product line and as well as a lot of other manufacturer products that we do. We also have a distribution side in Canada where we sell John Deere construction and ag equipment. So that's expanded into Australia and New Zealand as well. And it's a company that's aggressive and continues to grow on both manufacturing and the distribution side.
And that's kind of a neat partnership that you have with John Deere, because here in the States, a lot of the Brandt equipment is seen at John Deere dealerships, right?
Right. So, with our product line, and Brandt being a dealer too, we really understand the dealer network and what the dealer struggles and goes through every day. And, especially with John Deere, because we're right in there with them. So with that, paired that with, us being a premium product, it fits well with the Deere dealer network, and where that works, it's done really well. So, and we're not Deere exclusive. We do a lot with, Case, New Holland, Shortline dealers. So, we like to go to an area and pick, who we feel is the best fit to represent the product and go after those guys. So.
That's right. So if our listeners are curious and they want to look up more of your products, what's the best way for them to find it?
Yeah, so everything's online at brandt.ca and then Brandt Manufactured Products on all the social media.
That's great. Well, this has been a great time to kind of catch up. It's like I said, it's been a long-term relationship. We appreciate the dedication Brandt has to Farm for Profit and to our listeners. So it's kind of neat to continue to share what you guys have going with them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a great partnership with you guys, and looking forward to some big plans this coming year for sure.
Yeah, I think it'll be a lot of fun. I got some kind of cool ideas up our sleeve to see if we can get some neat content put together. But Kyle, thanks again for hanging out with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Tanner. Appreciate it.
Well, Tanner, a great interview there with Kyle. And we've got one more great interview for our listeners coming up. As we mentioned earlier, you're really not a weather guy, but we do have a weather guy joining us today with Eric Snodgrass.
That's right. I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express, but let's let Eric share the news here.
Well, Tanner, we're having a real weather guy on the podcast today, as opposed to just your weather update. Super excited to be joined today by Eric Snodgrass, Science Fellow with Nutrien Ag Solutions. Eric, thanks for joining. We're super excited to have you on with our new video format, because I think we've got some great charts and graphs we're going to be able to show our viewers.
Yeah, this has been an interesting spring. I'm glad you call me a real weather forecaster, because sometimes I feel like I'm an imposter. We had some struggles with this pattern. And if you would have had me record this with you 2 Mondays ago, I really thought, I had myself convinced that this pattern was going to break by this point. And then the very next day, the following Tuesday, we just had all that evidence crumble, and we saw that the pattern was going to sneak back into wet. And so, yeah, this has been a stressful spring. Interestingly enough, you know, complete opposite of last spring, right? I mean, at this point, we were 6 days into a 55-day stretch of no rainfall at all. And here we are talking about at least another 10 to 15 days of super tight windows. So, yeah, this is that's what the Midwest is, right? You never know what to expect, and I try my hardest to stay ahead of it. So here we go, spring weather.
Yeah, it certainly feels like a completely different spring from last year. And of course, a lot of our listeners don't have short-term memory loss. So there's been a lot of comparisons happening between what we got accomplished last year and where our farms are sitting this year. So why don't we kind of dive into what's the last month looked like for most of the Corn Belt?
Yeah, take a look at this graphic here. This is just the last 2 weeks, so really since the start of May. And if you take a look across much of the Corn Belt, there might be a couple of folks that are happy. They live in like East Central Illinois. There's like a spot right in through here that's been a little drier. But overall, we've been really, really wet. And if you stretch it out to a month, you can see that most of our areas have seen above normal precipitation. Now, I always struggle with this. And the reason I struggle with it is over the competition between operations and hydrology. It will not take much, and I don't think anyone's going to have short-term memory loss to remember what dryness looks like. I mean, we just have to go back to last fall, and we saw a significant dryness throughout our Corn Belt. We saw the Mississippi River spend months below its normal levels, and we had major concerns going through winter about recovery. But I'm sure you've seen the new drought monitor. I love the drought monitor. It's a great tool. You know, we've now got drought area down below 15% across the United States. And take a look at this soil moisture map. I mean, last fall, this entire area right in through here was just in the 2 percentile range. And here we are now looking at the 40-inch or 100-centimeter soil moisture percentile. In many places, it's, well, tiles running. We've got ditches that are full, creeks that are running, you know, little ponds that have got water in them. I mean, it's amazing. There is a spot. There are spots that are still dry. Got to talk about this winter wheat belt area getting into central Kansas. And despite some rains lately, you know, that area has been dry. But across the south, I mean, you've come down here to this part of Texas. We've got places that are 10 times the normal rainfall just in the last 30 days. And so to understand that, that means that they've had through the beginning of May their entire year's worth of rainfall already. And across the south, this is key because they have the ability across these southern growing areas to switch crops. So they may have planned on cotton, but they may switch to peanuts. And if that doesn't work, they may go to a different RM on corn or a different soybean because they couldn't get the peanuts going. And so there's going to be some major shifting around of acres across these really, really wet areas. And by the way, when I say really wet, I'm watching storms right here this morning that are going to go right over the top of these same areas, causing more flooding. And I even heard some farmers down in Louisiana for the first time in their careers talking about what prevent plant is. So this has been a bit of a headache, this pattern that we've been in. Oh, and never mind the fact we've had nearly 800 tornadoes so far to start this spring. So I don't know where you want me to stop when it comes to talking about this pattern, but I wish it would stop and get us over to something a little different.
Well, it's just amazing too, looking at soil moisture and subsoil moisture. The difference we've had even in the last month, if you look back to maybe early April compared to where we are now, it's so vastly different. Eric, the other big question I've been hearing from growers a lot, and I'm asking myself, is how does this year compare to the wet start we saw back in 2019?
Yeah, it's interesting. 2019 was a really interesting year. I have a really great website. It's this one that's run out of Iowa State. And if you come over here, you have the ability to plot by certain dates. So if we just do this, let's just do it quickly, just show folks how to do this. Let's go to 2019. Let's pick it up in May. We'll start on May the 1st. And then we'll roll through. How about we just go all the way to the end of May of 19? Because remember, we were planting corn in June of 19. So I'm going to use this color bar, total precipitation. The dates all look good. It'll take about 10, 15 seconds to plot this out. But while it's doing that, just listen. The difference between this year and 19 was that in 2019, we had two separate troughs that were going after us, one that was in Canada and one that was over California. And the two were coming together to hit the same spot. And here you go. Take a look at this map. That's what May of 19 looked like. Now you look at that and you go, holy smokes. Yes, it was much, much, much wetter than we currently are. And what helped it along was, again, a trough coming in from here, a trough coming in from there, and a large ridge of high pressure. So what do we get? We get flow that comes around this from the Gulf. The jet stream grabs that from the south, from the north, and it just hammered this area. So we're not quite there. But there's many people that are going, are you kidding me? This feels just like it. But a lot of those people live in Iowa, your state. They're talking like 19 because that's one of the wettest spots we've had as of late. Now, remember, what was odd about 19, it was a lot of us didn't plant corn until June. People that got corn in April told me that their June corn looked better than their April corn. And we didn't have a frost until late. So it's not as though we had this crazy late frost event. And since you're bringing this up, I'm going to show you something I made earlier this week. I was thinking a lot about GDDs, and particularly, are we going to be able to get enough? And so here's what I created. Actually, let's see if we can find this here. I really wanted to know, there it is. If you didn't plant till June 7th, how many GDDs can you get if you have your first frost on October 15? And if you take a look across Iowa, you still, on average, let's call October 15 first frost, we're still looking at 22 to 2600 GDDs. Now, does that mean you're going to have to change RM? Possibly. I don't know, but it's not as though it's the same situation that the Dakotas have, where if they don't plant until June, they're looking at 1800 GDDs versus us getting, you know, another 600 or 700 during that time frame. So it's just a point to make, right? We have to think about all of this in perspective and understand that these next 2 weeks, I think, are critical to finish this planting, and we're going to be finding some tight windows during that time frame.
Yeah, so I think the big question is, Eric, what's it going to take to break this pattern? What's our forecast look like? Is it going to end soon?
Not soon enough. And I can show you five different models in their view of this. So what it's going to take is you've got to break down. So the jet stream has just loved to do this. Dip troughs in the west, they come over the Rocky Mountains, eject into lows that then roll across. They have open access to Gulf moisture. That's been the story we've had. You have to get rid of the western U.S. trough. And in the next 7 to 10 days, we don't do that. So the map I've been drawing on here is kind of our artificial intelligence forecast. This is something new from the Europeans. And if we kind of just zoom in here, because today all the flood threats down south, but if we zoom in here and look specifically at the Midwest, you know, these are not huge rainfall totals, but any rain is a problem. And so you can see that while we hit a little bit of a break from now through this weekend in Iowa, the systems that are coming through next week, we're looking at maybe another inch and a half of rain. That's possible. It's not just this model. I mean, take a look at the national blend of models. See the color range in through here? Looking at more wet conditions. So this next, I'll call it 4 days, is going to be absolutely critical for folks if they can find some drier fields to get in the upper Midwest and the Midwest. Here's the WPC forecast. Here's the European model forecast. I mean, I could flip through these fast because they all say the same story. And if we just break this down into probabilities over the next 10 days, this is the chance of getting at least an inch of rain. And we see here that a big section of our corn belt has a better than 80% chance of grabbing another inch. And any rain at this point is problematic. So again, it's still not as wet as 19. And it is certainly not looking like, I mean, Iowa, as you remember, 1993, this is not a 93 setup as we go into spring, June, really. But my goodness, it's been wet.
So Eric, as we look a little longer term into the actual growing season, starting to hear some differing opinions maybe on, are we going to continue with this wet pattern or are we going to switch to hot and dry this summer? What's your take on that?
Here it is in just a quick blanket statement. Most of the evidence I have right now is that we have a hot, stormy summer. And I hate to say this because I know the two of you are in Iowa, but the year that is lining up more closely for me for the summer pattern, not right now, but the summer pattern is 2020. The ocean temperature pattern looks very similar. And if you remember that summer, we had, you know, a big ridge that parked over the southwest. I'll draw on this map just to make a point here. There's a big ridge over the southwest in summer 2020. So that's where all the heat and high pressure was. And storms cascaded over the northern side of that all summer long. And of course, we had in August the derecho event. Now, I'm not calling for that. Okay, we can't make that statement this early. But if we get a big ridge over the southwest, that's what you can end up getting. So why don't we go ahead and take a look at maybe what June could be, and I'll show you what the newest European model forecast is looking like. And this is the 30-day outlook. Now, if you look at this, we start to see drier conditions kind of showing up in that corridor. And it seems to want to stay, see the greens in here, seems to stay a little bit stormy in this area. What is really interesting to me is to show you the temperature pattern. Let's do this kind of on a week-by-week basis. So here's what we got going through the next couple weeks. There's a little bit of cooler air coming in. There's no frost with this. Don't worry about it. But to finish off May with all that wet weather, we're just a little cooler. But take a look at what happens into June. You see where the heat's building? Texas, the Western Plains. It's down there in the four corner states. And what this means is if we end up getting ridging happening here, remember, we don't have drought to our south. We've been eating away the drought that's been to our southwest. We don't have drought to our northwest, which means we don't have anything to overcome, meaning that if we anchor a big area of high pressure right in through here, the flow comes over the top, we get northwest flow and summer thunderstorm activity. Now that presents its own set of challenges, right? If you end up having a hot and stormy summer, there's other management things we have to take into account to ensure that our crop does well. But I don't have today evidence to tell you that there's going to be major, major drought issues. If I did, it would be a discussion like this. Let me bring up current ocean temperatures, and I'm gonna say this. You see this warm blob of water? If over the next 40 days that just fills in this area, our risk for a hot, stormy summer goes up. If that warm water comes back here just a little bit, and this all stays cool, that'll plant a ridge of high pressure here. We'll have another one right there. We'll have another one right here. And that is the most feared pattern for drought in the Midwest. But watch, what if you shift that high there? This guy tends to go here. And this one, it's interestingly enough, tends to kind of join it there. And what does that all do? Well, if you put high pressure here, the flow goes over the top of it, cascades down, and then that high come over here is where it bounces back up, and we're in great shape for summer thunderstorms. So it's all about the positioning of those highs, Delaney. And I bet you weren't looking forward for like an entire course on this today, but that's what I'm watching. This is the uncertainty going forward.
It's always fascinating to see all of the different factors that impact where your drought may be, where your rains are going to be. So
yeah, and
I love the lesson.
I didn't even talk about La Nina. Like La Nina is here. And we always give La Nina so much credit that I don't think it deserves. Because the reality is, if you are going to sink a major drought in this area, La Nina's got to be coming on strong. This has to stay really cold. This has to stay really cold. And that combination of events drops it in there. So the most important thing to watch is right here. And I'll show you one other thing since you brought this up, and I'll keep going with it. Take a look at this. This is what the forecast models, here it is. Let me take you back. There it is. That's what the forecast models were calling for June, July, August, when they made their forecast in April. And look, they had put drought right over the top of you. The National Multimodal Ensemble did that. The Europeans said, it looks stormy. They then updated these this month, and now the new model took that risk out. See it? I mean, it's no longer looking as dry. They're trying to plant all the drought here. The European model kept you stormy. So this is that same story. If we have to just make a call today, May 16, about where this is going, I think we have risk of ridging over the southeast, or southwest, excuse me, and that pumps storms through. If I knew this perfectly, I wouldn't have answered the phone when you called today. I'd be up in Chicago making trades on this, right? So the point is just to let you know that these are the things we're watching. So good questions.
And that's good. I mean, we don't have a lot of extra time, but I do want to hit on the weather in South America. Can you kind of give us an update as to what's happening there and what type of impact that might have to close this out?
Yeah. So if we take a look, let's look at this particular graphic. We have had, this is Rio Grande do Sul. Now, this is a global map, but right here is Rio Grande do Sul getting into southern Brazil. There's been some places in here that have measured over 30 inches of rain in the last month. Now, they don't grow a safrinha crop down there. That's all full season crop that just got flooded out by the time we get to harvest. The monsoon slowed down a bit early, about 2.5 weeks early, but there is forecast for some better rains coming up toward Mato Grosso do Sul out of Parana, which may help with grain fill. So I think we're going to have to wait on some sort of a story out of safrinha crop that could surprise the markets later in June when they're harvesting. But I think the bigger story right now is the fact that Rio Grande do Sul has been flooding. And this is a 10-day forecast map saying it's going to continue to flood in that area. So that's the big story coming out of South America as they finish up their growing season.
And Eric, I noticed you had a Russian wheat chart open, so I'm going to hit that really fast too before we wrap, because that certainly has had the wheat markets excited this week, is the potential issues going on in Russia.
Yeah, so this is kind of that Russian winter wheat map. And remember, they grow a lot of other stuff in here too. So this is just, this is their productive area. There's Ukraine, there's the Black Sea for geographic reference. So we got really cold right in north of that line, like really cold over the last 10 days, a lot of frost events. The other issue has been we've been dry down here. So if you look back over the last 30 days, it's been as dry here, as wet as it's been in China. Like they've been complete opposites of one another, major flooding south of the Yangtze. And so, you know, if we go look, let's go back here. There we go. The artificial intelligence forecast model continues to keep that area drier. We just have questions as to what this means to any crop that's grown in this area, either one that's finishing or one that's going in the ground, and what it might mean in terms of total production. So a lot of big uncertainties. And I'll tell you, Delaney, what I've been getting asked a lot about is, are they concerned, and am I concerned about a 2010 repeat in this area? Now, tossing out the year 2010 is like tossing out the year 2012 if you're a Midwest farmer, right? So that's a major, major drought wildfire year for this area. And to be honest, I can't say that that's what I'm looking at now, but it needs to be watched carefully.
Well, Eric, it's been a pleasure as always. If our listeners want to connect with you or get your updates on a more frequent basis, how do they do that?
Yeah, great way. Just go to agweather.com, ag-wx.com. That's where all my content is, all my maps. You can sign up for my weekly report free here. I make YouTube videos every day. They go there. And if you need a forecast, you just come right on in here and you can create it. In fact, where are you sitting right now? I'll show you this real fast. Tell me a location. You said Ames, right? You were near Ames?
Yep, that's
right,
correct.
Well, click on Ames and you want to know if you're going to be able to plant. Well, I'm running you a forecast. Let's take a look. Here's your 10-day precipitation outlook, man. I hope I don't ruin you right now. There's that Monday, Tuesday rainfall that's coming in. So here it is. You got to use this. If you can get in there and use that, do it, because it's not just the ECMWF, but the European model combined with the GFS is wet. And I hate to say it, but the Blenda models is wet as well. So go get it. If you can find it, go get it, because that's your window right there.
That's right. Well, it sounds like we need to wrap up so I can get in the field. We appreciate it as always, Eric. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah, you bet. Good talking to you guys.
Well, Tanner, as we take a look at the markets this week, wheat continues to be the driving factor for the grains as it helps support both corn and beans early in the trading sessions this week. The primary concern for the markets is Russian production issues, as Eric mentioned there, caused by weather. Current estimates suggest that Russia will have just 4 to 5 million metric tons of surplus of old crop stocks on hand above its normal level at the end of the marketing year to work through. Russia has reported the recent freeze damage will require replanting of about 500,000 hectares on top of the existing drought problems that are already negatively impacting at least a third of Russia's winter wheat crop and up to half of Ukraine's crop. Following the quick flash-in-the-pan reaction, all three wheat classes closed lower for the third consecutive day. So it was really just a short-term blimp on the radar there, Tanner.
That's right. And on the demand side, the picture of what we're taking a look at, weekly export sales were reportedly lackluster this week. China continues to revise its soybean demand downward, citing a smaller hog herd, which will require less rations for feed. Regardless, Chinese buyers purchased roughly 30 cargoes of soybeans last week, primarily for shipment in June and July, and primarily sourced from Brazil, which continues to be priced well below the U.S. prices all the way through September. So that was the end of another one of our good shows, Delaney. Excited to get back in the field and get some crops put in the ground this weekend before some more rain that comes on Tuesday. Just like Eric said, I got to get to work.
Yeah, you do. We better send you off and send all of our listeners off to have a great weekend. Hopefully you get a lot of acres planted this weekend and you'll get some timely rains right after that on Monday.
That's right. So what do you say? Should we let the listeners go?
Let's let them go.